make a deal. The real Jack Lissenberry is a much taller and thinner and better looking man. I'd like to give a shout out to our news director here, Vince Duffy. Where are you? There he is, Jack. He's an enormously powerful person who decides what the news is. And if he gets... That's right. If he gets bored, he may cause another earthquake in Nepal. On my right, not necessarily politically, is the most knowledgeable woman about Michigan politics since Helen Milliken passed away, Zoe Clark, who is the... She's the executive producer of Stateside, and she's also the co-host of It's Just Politics, which she does with Rick Plute on Michigan Radio. That's an interesting one with sound effects. Next to him is Jonathan Osting. Did I do that right? He's the main minister of the Dutch Reform. No, he's a capital reporter for M Live Media Group and a very, very fine and talented writer. And, and next to him is, I'm so tempted to stay on my far right, but I won't. Is Matt Marsden, who is now public affairs director for Six Data Systems. Not quite clear what that is, maybe he'll tell us. But before that, he worked for a whole lot of Republican politicians, including Senate Majority Leader Randy Richardville, Mike Bishop before him, and former Congressman Joe Schwartz, and I think Abraham Lincoln. But what they are, these folks really know their stuff. And what we're going to do is I'm going to ask them a couple sort of general interest questions. And then, as Steve said, we're going to turn to the audience. Raise your hand, and I'll call on you, and Kristen gets over the microphone. And I think you all know who we are now. Say briefly, say your name and what you do. I think it'd be nice to know what perspective you're coming from and give people a chance to see you do your stuff too. So with that, I'm going to start. I just want to talk about two topics. You, by the way, you are panelists, or you in the audience are welcome to ask about anything. Proposal one. Six days from now, we're going to vote on proposal one. And everybody I talk to about proposal one seems to be quite confused about it, what it would do, if it's as advertised. And so I'd like each of our panelists to just comment briefly on maybe what they think the biggest myth about the proposal is, and address one thing specifically which people ask me all the time, which is, how do we know that if we vote for this money, the legislature won't just steal it again like they did with the lottery money and use it for something else? So let's start with Matt, because he actually has been known to talk to some of these folks.
Well, I think that Proposal 1 is probably one of the most confusing ballot proposals that they could possibly cobble together in a very short amount of time and lame duck, all trying to get out before Christmas and go home to their families. Bipartisan in nature, awful difficult for anyone here to understand or explain or have any guarantees and assurances. I think the campaign has been frayed and broken. I think that it probably is going to fail by a margin of 69 to maybe 31%.
Okay, well, I've always wanted to try this. Governor Snyder, every roads event he does, asks people, raise your hands if you like our roads right now. As he says, nobody ever does, but raise your hands if you understand proposal.
This is called relentless negative action.
Yeah, Snyder doesn't ask that second question. Proposal one, I think one of the biggest issues, as you mentioned, Jack, people always ask, well, why should we trust the legislators on this? They didn't just approve a tax increase on their own, so they're asking us to approve that. It's a fair question, because this would change the Constitution to raise new money, but statutorily, that's the only protection that this money, most of this money, well, 60% of this money, would go to roads. Lawmakers can revisit that issue again in the future. Is it politically viable that they will? No, I don't think so. I think most likely if this ballot proposal does pass, about $1.25 billion of the $2 billion it will raise will go to roads for the foreseeable future.
I think one of the biggest issues and that I've heard a lot is the word punt when it comes to this. And that's this idea that lawmakers couldn't do it on their own, so they punted to all of us to do it for them. And I think those who are saying that is an absolutely fair characterization, but you were asking about some of the concerns, some of the myths, and one of them is, though, there is one part of this proposal that you lawmakers, they have to look to you for, and that is the state sales tax. It's part of the Constitution. In order to raise a state sales tax, that is something that constitutionally voters have to decide on. So it may be a punt. I think a lot of people fairly are calling it that, but that is one of the reasons that it didn't have to make it on the ballot.
And a quick follow-up, starting going in opposite order with Zoe. The governor likes to say, if this fails, there is no plan B. And if it does fail, what will happen?
Well, first of all, that's the most maddening thing to say, because right now they've done polling, the Say Yes campaign, and what they've clued in on is this idea of safety. And that's what you're going to be hearing about. That is what you've been hearing about. The advertisements, pamphlets, you have to vote on this for the safety of your families. And I call a little on this, because if it is an issue of safety, if the governor is so worried about families and driving on the roads, but he doesn't have a plan B if this fails, that's a lack of leadership. So this idea when someone says there isn't a plan B, either there better be a plan B and you better just admit you don't want to talk about it, or you're really, really not doing a good job if the roads are so dangerous.
Proposal one is at best probably plan C or D.
Sure, right.
The governor, first of all, was supporting a gas tax increase combined with a registration fee increase. That wasn't palatable to a lot of people in the state legislature, particularly Republicans, who said they never vote for a tax increase. So this already is,
Plan H,
sure. If this fails, certainly there's going to be some readjustments of the budget that's working its way through Lansing right now, and probably they'll try and put some more one-time money in this year, which they've done in the last 4 years, while they continue to debate it. Is there a viable solution, long-term solution? It's going to be tough. I mean, it has been tough for the last 3 years, most definitely. So when the governor says there's no plan B, that's not true. Is there a viable plan B that remains to be seen?
Yeah, there is a viable plan B. It's $500 million. Okay, that's what it's going to take to fund the roads. Now, let's look at the overall budget. We've got a $600 million shortfall in MEDC credits. We've got about $180 million in healthcare costs under the changes that recently happened. We have $500 million shortfall in roads. And we have the UAW who's going to go out and renegotiate their contracts soon, which is going to end up costing the state some more money. So do we have a deficit? Yes. Can we move forward with the existing road projects for this year at the tune of $500 million? That will be up to the Senate and the legislature to figure out where to find that. Does it come out of the Pure Michigan funding? Does it come out of education? Does it come out of public health, public safety? Where is it going to come from?
So, Matt, are you coming from the idea then, which some conservative Republicans are coming from, which is there is money in the Michigan budget right now without any kind of increases in taxes or revenue enhancement, as the word is that folks like to say, that we could actually find the money within the budget?
I thought taxing people's pensions was supposed to have fixed the problem. And I thought maybe that was going to be the solution. So, I mean, the reality is that, no, we don't have enough money. There's going to have to be a way to find that. Either you're going to raise taxes in some way, shape, or form that's palatable to you as the citizens, or you're going to have to find a couple of new revenue streams that maybe don't cost you money.
How do you find a new revenue stream that doesn't cost you money?
Well, you can legalize a cash crop. In all seriousness, folks, I mean, this is an agricultural-based state. $55 million of our agricultural business comes from cash crops. If you decided to properly regulate and gain global control and could generate a revenue stream, you could possibly generate anywhere from $200 million to $800 million in taxable revenue a year. Now, that is money that you don't have to pay for if you choose not to participate. There ain't no tax, like a sin tax.
Okay. One last thing, so on the same thing. Governor Snyder has been playing footsie with running for president or something. I don't know. He's been very coy about this. But if, Matt, as you predict, the voters hand him his head in the bag next Tuesday, is that going to be the end of that?
yeah, that's going to be the end of that. I think that probably was the end of that before he even filed the 501c4 paperwork. But I think what the governor is doing here is not necessarily running for president per se, but I think he is definitely going out and looking to be a surrogate. I think he wants to go out and he wants to look to see if he can get attached to the right candidate that's going to run and win, and he might find himself in a cabinet position somewhere, thereby furthering his agenda and then installing the now lieutenant governor in a 2-year incumbent position to run against whoever the next gubernatorial candidate is. Continue the dynasty, if you will.
And let's be clear about something, too. There's no reason right now for the governor not to play footsie, even if he has no plans to run. There is no reason for him to come out right now and say, absolutely not, I'm not thinking about it. It doesn't hurt him.
He doesn't know anything.
Well, unless he really wanted to be here to help Proposal 1 pass instead of going...
And this is an issue that Jack, you and I talked about on air today, that Zach Warchow, another great reporter in Lansing at Bonware News Service, was talking about, which, you know, 6 days out of the past 2 weeks going into Proposal 1, the governor will have been out of the state. Telling Michigan's story.
I just like to point out, I don't think the failure of Proposal 1 is really going to make a difference in the governor's potential presidential run. If it passes, it's probably going to hurt him more in a Republican primary.
But I don't quite understand that thinking. You say, the governor says, okay, hey, vote for me. I couldn't even get the Republican legislature to do what I wanted, and I couldn't get the people to do what I asked them to do. Boy, that's a big selling point.
I think it's a lose-lose, honestly. He's the presidential candidate that raised taxes by $2 billion. How is that going to play in the GOP primary?
Yeah, and the other thing is, though, Matt, I want to push you a little bit, because I think there has been a lot of talk about a possible cabinet position, VP. I was talking to someone recently close to Snyder, though, who said, look, it's hard for me to imagine him in that position. This is a dude that for decades has been in charge of everything, right? Executive at Gateway, chief executive now of the state. You know, yeah, does he want to be part of DC politics? Maybe, although he's constantly talking about how dysfunctional
but,
DC
but
is.
But as I said to Zoe this morning, when I still was wearing my pajamas with feet in them, and the fact that, I think the lady protests too much. I said that long before any of these people were born, Michigan had a Snyder-like governor by the name of George Romney, another corporate executive type, and he ended up, after saying the same, I don't want to be anybody's standby, but becoming Secretary of HUD, which is, you know, in terms of cabinet prominence, slightly less important than the guy who opens the door to let the rest of them in. So they never say never. But I want to turn at this point to the audience, because we're all tired of each other.
Please.
And feel free to also, what I would like you to do, raise your hand, Kristen will come to you, and then I'll call on you and say your question. Don't make a speech. I'm a very good Nazi about cutting you off, and ask any question. Yes, sir.
Hi, my name is Dave Melke. I'm retired and was a dean of a college of business in Southeast Michigan for a number of years. I think your opening question or ask for comments about the biggest myth, I think there's really two big myths. One is on the tax side, the other is on the spending side. This has been sold about roads and sales tax to increase funding for roads, but we really have three tax increases. We have the state tax on gasoline going from 17 to 41.7 cents a gallon, which will immediately raise our taxes on our cost on gasoline. We have a second, which is the increase on the registration fees. You'll no longer have your 10% depreciation in each of the first 4 years. And really, there may be a fourth tax that's associated, and that is you'll lose your deduction if you itemize your income taxes because that registration fee will no longer be deductible. So I'd like to hear some comments about that. On the spending side, we certainly have $700 million plus going to fix problems that the legislature has not been dealing with. One being in local government funding, second, education, third, the earned income tax credit, and the fourth, maybe you can help me with
that. Mass transit?
mass transit, which will have a 40% increase.
Yeah.
So there really are two myths, one on the tax side and one on the spending side. And I think those ought to be addressed and there ought to be transparency. And if there are problems with those other areas, the legislature ought to fix them.
And I'm going to yell like that if I have to pay all those taxes.
Wait a minute. The legislative people.
Well, let me say just one part of that that I think you may be setting up a myth of your own, which is the Earned Income Tax Credit, which is a case of restoring something that Ronald Reagan said was the best program ever in terms of. But when it also helps the economy because this puts money in the pocket of the working poor who immediately spend it and has a multiplier effect. So that is probably that.
If you look at the dollars associated with that increase are minimal. If you get $50 more in earned income tax credit as a result of this change, because it's going to be 20% of the federal amount you get, not 20%. So take a look at the numbers and you'll see that there's very, very little increase.
Well, I don't claim to be an economist, but Charles Ballard, who's the head of the economics department at MSU, told me he thought this would make a significant positive effect, but somebody else and somebody
sure.
else.
No, there's been two studies that have looked at that particular, and it's a smaller slice of people, of course, people who qualify for the EITC.
Right.
For those people, for some of them who are in the maximum EITC zone, they might actually come out ahead on proposal one by a very narrow margin. Now, that means the rest of the public is not. I mean, there have been a couple studies pegging the average tax increase at about $500 per household. The AP came up with that figure. The Mackinac, which is a conservative think tank, came up with that figure. So yeah, it's a complex tax formula. You're totally right. Gas taxes will go up, not quite from 17 to 41, because we currently place sales tax on our gasoline. And that would be exempted. So let's say gas is $3, you pay 18 cents on top of that, you pay 35 cents tax. Now it's going up to 51, 41. So
this is confusing.
Right. No, exactly. You can't do any of this in the 8-second soundbite. I want to get into something, though, too, that you added, which, right, we're talking right now about Proposal 1 as the roads funding ballot. And you're absolutely right that there is money to restore part of the EITC. There is money. That's going to education. And why is that? Because of pure politics. That because Governor Snyder couldn't get his fellow Republicans to figure out a plan, he needed to grab Democrats. And how do you do that? By giving money to schools, by giving money to the working poor, and that's why this is part of it. I mean, some folks are calling it, you know, this Christmas tree, so many ornaments on it, but that's what this governor had to do. This was the kind of horse trading to get something done because Republicans couldn't come together to figure out their own plan. The governor had to look to Democrats, and this is what, you know, he gave them basically in order for some votes and the, you know, end of lame duck.
It's also a very poorly run campaign. Having worked on PPT, the last statewide ballot proposal, which we won 69-31, a very difficult subject matter to explain to people. But we buckled down and we targeted people and we found out what your message was. What do we need to tell you? What do we need to explain to you to get you to understand the complicated issue? And we took that time and we sent you very specific mail. And I think what you've seen here is a campaign that got off to a bumpy start, whether it was the administration that made that decision or not, whether it was that they chose to pick a May 5th date, which is a strange time to pick one, considering there's nothing else on the ballot that any of you have any interest in going out to support.
It's Karl Marx's birthday.
Well, that's a darker reason. That's why they did it. And only you would know that, Frank.
If the administration came to you and said, hey, will you run the campaign A1, would you have said yes?
We did say yes. We were part of the original team of folks that decided to.
I didn't know that.
Why did the governor fire me?
Why'd you get fired? We were not fired.
I mean, we did.
Why did you part company?
I think that they had a difference in opinion in terms of what I just explained to you. They wanted to run something that we thought there's a window about this big by which we can shoot your plan, okay? And literally, it's this big. And we got to do it the way we need to do it to win. And if somebody's going to say to you, well, we need you to use this person or that person, and you got to do this and that and the other thing, we're in the business of winning campaigns at Rev 610. That's what we do. We win campaigns. I'm not going to take on a campaign that has this much room for me to win
and then had it jammed up in the end. So we said, listen, it's just best if all of us together, and that's why everybody left in mass, and said, then do it the way you want to do it. And now you find them where they are today. And that's okay, but there's lessons to be learned. Statewide ballot proposals are very, very difficult campaigns to run and win.
I don't disagree with any of that or anything my fellow panelists have said, but at this point, I want to assert my prerogative to show that I'm a grumpy, sour, bitter old man. When I was young, I was briefly attracted to the libertarians before I realized I'd need state services as much as anyone else. And the little cell of libertarians that I used to hang out with, they're all 15-year-old boys. They had a slogan that they would write on the walls that said, it looked like it said pen staff. And I said, what does that mean? I thought it was some kind of Norwegian word for sex. And it said, there ain't no such thing as a free lunch. By which I mean, the roads are in awful shape. They are not going to heal themselves. If you do not pass this, they will get worse and worse, and they will cost more and more in the long run to fix whenever we do fix them, and they will drive business away. If you vote no on this, and it looks like a majority of people will, you should do so with open eyes. The tooth fairy will not come and fix the roads. The legislature will not say something, my God, we should do our jobs, let's do this in a responsible way. We have a great infrastructure crisis in Michigan, and is this a perfect proposal? It's a lousy proposal. It's a lousy way to do it. But you know what? If people demanded perfection, none of us would ever have a partner. None of us, and all of us should have studied math harder in school, and all of us should exercise more, except for maybe Steve. And so reality and politics are the art of the possible. End of rant. Next question. Okay. Yes, sir.
Jerry Dunn, I'm retired, and I...
What were you before you retired?
Well, I was a firefighter. Okay. And now I drive for a car company. But our problems go much deeper than the roads here. They go to things like ALEC in our local legislature. They go to things like money in Washington, which is affecting the money that gets to here. The biggest problem we have, I think, in this country is money buying our legislatures. If you can't, you know, the Bible, and I'm not a, you know, this is just from the Bible, but you can't love one person and follow another. Your heart will go one way or the other. So you have to have real independent making of decisions. And money is ruining our ability to deal with our situation. I haven't heard anything about axle weight for our roads. Why are, you know, Minnesota has nice roads. Wisconsin has nice roads. Their axle weights are...
What you're saying is Michigan has about the highest tolerance for heavy trucks.
That's right.
I wonder if anyone here is an expert on transportation could address if that's really a problem, because I've heard it both ways.
Well, it certainly brought up a lot. In fact, the Senate did take a vote on a bill to lower truck weights to 80,000. They're currently, I think, 160. So we are twice the federal limit right now. That bill failed. While, as you mentioned, the truck lobby was driving big rigs around the Capitol honking their horns. I don't know if they were related. But, there have been some studies, and it's hard to trust the studies, because they're all done by, like, government agencies that have an interest in this issue. But Michigan does have some unique rules with regards to spreading out weight on axles. And MDOT has cited studies, I don't know if they actually produced them, showing that by spreading out that weight, they actually do less damage than two trucks carrying that same weight would be. So it's an academic argument. I don't know if there's been definitive study to say one way or another, but the common sense would tell you if we have twice the legal weight limit, that might be an issue.
Speaking of MDOT, I think that had this campaign started with a different message, and I'll ask you, how many of you have been driven down a road that you saw having construction being done on it the summer before, and then the same barrels are out there again the next year, and again the next year after that? And if the question would have been, are we going to prescribe a larger degree of accountability
to MDOT as a transportation department, as well as the road builders, and we are going to hold them responsible for failed road projects, because a lot of the costs are through failed products that have gone into the roads. And to your point, sir, truck weights and other things that we could have taken into consideration reform for. I bet if I said, if I could guarantee you that if you vote yes on a sales tax, we're going to have greater accountability in MDOT and the road builders, and everybody else are going to be held accountable for the crappy build of the roads. You probably would have said yes to this.
And that, what is that going on right now with MDOT? I'm hearing a lot of rumors that MDOT is sort of the least most like, aside from maybe the MEDC right now, and that this is where a lot of the spotlight is coming to next. We're seeing a lot of surveys. What are the politics behind that?
It's just a very entrenched bureaucratic organization that has for years held sway over. I mean, we had the same director as we have for, 8 years now? I mean, nothing against him personally, but sometimes organizations need to be reborn. Sometimes they need to reshape themselves. Sometimes they need a little bit of a clean.
I asked the leadership of MDOT recently about this very subject, about whether they fixed the roads in a shoddy manner and grew them, and they said they said, that's absolutely false. We never fixed the roads in a shoddy manner, and we're not going to do it anymore.
There are some additional warranty requirements in Prop 1.
There are.
But there's also been an audit that just came out that showed Michigan's fledgling warranty program wasn't run all that well. So you're basically extending those
further. Keep that in mind as you're reading papers and stories soon. I think more and more accountability and stories about MDOT in the future.
I just wanted to make one more quick point, and that is that, you know, our governor came to office, gave away $1.8 billion to encourage corporations or businesses to locate here and create jobs. What's wrong with the idea of giving that money after they've done it? I mean, who gives away money in hopes that someone will do something? Why not reward them for actually making and creating jobs here?
I agree.
Well, but I'll point out that the governor was reelected. Anyway, next question.
By a thin margin.
Well, he got reelected.
Jack, it's so good to see you again.
Get your eyes fixed.
When are we going to have coffee again? It's been years. Anyways, digress. My name is Karen Moraes, and I'm a former freelance writer with the Metro Times, and Jack is just a very near and dear colleague and friend of mine. Currently, I'm a second-year law student and I'm also a legal assistant with the Public Defender Office. My question is why in the world hasn't this legislature thought about doing toll roads? I used to live in Madison, Wisconsin, and you know, you spend about 2 hours on the outskirts of Chicago, and yes, you have to stop. I think it's like every 25 miles, but it was the best ride ever. Yeah, and I've talked to other people who have drove through other states where you have to pay the toll, and the same experience.
Jonathan, you look like you'd be a good man in a toll booth. What's the answer?
I actually have written about this before. So the freeway system, as we know it, was created to be free. And when Michigan took federal money to build its highways, it essentially agreed to keep those open and free. So if you try and convert a road that receives federal funding into a toll road, you currently can't, although the federal government is now allowing a few pilot projects. So there's been a handful of projects around the state where they're allowing states to convert existing highways. So we've all been on the Ohio Turnpike, most likely. I believe that one was built new as a toll road. So we could build new highways and make them tolls, or we could add new lanes, potentially, onto existing highways and charge tolls on those roads. But as it stands now, under federal law, we can't just start charging.
Karen, that was a hell of an idea in 1951.
The federal government is dealing with the same road funding crisis that we are here in Michigan, because the federal gas tax is pulling the most money. So they are exploring ways to give states more flexibility to do things like toll roads. So maybe it'll happen in a few years where that's a possibility. But as of now, it's a sort of a bureaucratic nightmare to try to get that done.
Plus, there's another problem. Apart from the one, you need several billion dollars to build the roads themselves. Michigan, Ohio, Pennsylvania, these are states people traverse to get to other states. Michigan, you pretty much go to Michigan to be in Michigan, unless you're trying to get to northern Canada or kill wolves or something. So I think most people who study it think it's not very efficient, but it's a good thought. Somebody else.
Yeah,
okay.
A question.
Hello, my name is Derek, a former staff member of Michigan Legislature. I kind of want to push both of you on this because you're kind of, in my opinion, letting the legislature.
Both of who?
You, Jack, and Zoe.
Okay.
You're kind of letting the legislature off easy.
Oh, okay.
Zoe,
your former boss was, I'm not happy.
Yeah.
I got it. Okay.
Wait, did you quit?
Yeah, I'm going to law school at Lewis and Clark this fall, so I have to.
And tell folks who you used to work for.
No.
Then I'm not so sure I want to answer your question.
It was David J.
No, so
does that
ultimately fall on the legislature to make budget decisions? And I kind of want to push you both and invoke Immanuel Kant on this. Shouldn't they do the right thing because it's their duty to do the right thing? And that's what we've elected them to do.
Right, and that's the point. We've elected them. So doesn't it come back to us then about who we're electing?
You want to answer for me? What you're saying is absolutely true, but it is absolutely idealistic. It proves the wisdom of what you said proves my contention that our system is irretrievably broken. That unless we have a new constitution at some point, the wheels can't go back on the bus because of term limits, because of gerrymandering. The system just doesn't work, and this is the ultimate proof of that. Of course the legislature has not done its duty, but as intelligent and beautiful as she is, Zoe can't seem to make them do it.
No, I mean, and here's the thing, absolutely, right? Like, I used to so want to work in politics. I wanted to be a press secretary. I grew up in the West Wing watching Generation, that it was all white, soft light and doing good.
It's
and
not.
I know, and I've come to realize that, and man, is that just the saddest thing in all the land. But I do think that there is something to be said for a knowledgeable citizenry, and the problem is, we're all here together tonight talking politics, so I'm not talking to you folks about being knowledgeable citizenry, right? This is what the Founding Fathers wanted, us all sitting around talking about the issues, better understanding things. Unfortunately, right now, I'm not so sure that that's the majority of folks. So, yes, it's the lawmaker's fault, but there's also something to be said for voters, or the lack thereof voters. I mean, look at voter turnout in Michigan, and what we're talking about this vote in May, that apparently is huge, right? That it could increase the sales tax, and we're looking at, you know, a 23%, and that would be high.
No,
I'm saying that would be, like, gorgeous if 1 in 4 voters came to vote. So yes, I don't mean to say that it's not the lawmakers and that they need to be doing the work and that they should, but who's holding their feet to the fire? Well, it's voters. And again, that's not us in this room. I don't mean to, you know, say like, oh, we're all wonderful, we're great, but at least we're here talking about it. At least we know what Proposal 1 is. So I do think, yes, that lawmakers, totally on them, but I do think that regular citizens of Michigan have some responsibility too.
My name is Jerry Diamond, and I hate the term gerrymandering.
Could you say that? I'm sorry, just speak a little louder.
My name is Jerry Diamond, and I hate the term gerrymandering, just for information there. And I'm a business owner in Ann Arbor. And the thing that concerns me a little bit with the 1% or whatever the increase is, and maybe I'm being naive, but that's going to be a forever thing. And yes, we have to fix our roads. I absolutely agree with that. My question is, why couldn't there be like an assessment that would go on for 2 years, 3 years, whatever, to be able to fix the roads and not tag other things on top
what
of it?
What kind of assessment?
Relentless positive action from this governor. It's got to be done now in this way.
Well,
right.
I mean, don't we have, for property taxes, we have, or for parks and recreation, I mean, for different things, we have assessments that only last so long. And maybe it's a gas tax, maybe it's a sales tax, but this one here is going to be forever, and it's never going to go down, it's only going to go up.
Matt, legally, how would you do that? How would you do a temporary assessment? How could they do that?
I would imagine that they could Well, they, first of all, they got to fix the problem to begin with and say, okay, what's the funding level that we need to do for the roads to keep it going for the next year? Let's establish that. Let's be honest about it. It's not $1.2 billion. Now, $500, $700 million to finish the project. You got to remember, MDOT sets these seven-year plans, right? We got to put this in May because we have to get this on the ballot so we can fund the project. Yes, that project was funded 2 years before into the seven-year plan, right? So these guys have a plan where you could do just what you said. Fund it at the existing level and then set up some sort of an oversight department inside of MDOT that's going to do this is probably what I would say.
So why hasn't that happened?
Well, I don't work there anymore.
It's an area of all these people used to work in Lansing, and now no longer.
But I think, Jonathan, correct me if I'm wrong, I think you're giving a sort of a false impression unintentionally, Matt. The problem is not just the 500-something million dollars for this year, is it? It's down the road. Every year these things are working out.
Yes, but I also find it interesting that if you take the number that I gave you earlier, $600 million, $180 million, $500 million plus a shortfall from a UAW negotiation, you're at what number? Pretty close to $1.2 billion. So forgive me for being a cynic, but that's the shortfall, and that's the amount they're trying to collect.
Sure, to the governor's credit, he's pushing a long-term road funding solution. They've added general fund money to the budget each of the last 4 years. They have done that. It's been in the $200 to $400 million range when all has been said and done. So the governor, who is an accountant, likes to budget out until 2030 or some ridiculous number like that, to his credit, is thinking long term. Because this is a problem that it's not, you don't just dump a bunch of money into it and it's solved. That happened actually in, 2009, was it, when we got stimulus money? Michigan got a huge influx of cash under former Governor Granholm, pumped that all into roads, and suddenly the roads got a lot better. But once that one-time money ran out, the current trajectory...
And it was the same with the schools.
Yeah, sure. So.
Talking about the federal match either. The state continues to not get its full federal match from the United States Congress. Okay, that should be adjusted as well, to your point. And to his point about the long-term budget, absolutely, that is the plan. But all of you in this room are going to pay for it for that whole time.
Can I change the subject? Just for maybe people are not done with the road yet, but I want to talk about sex and death. Death, first of all, there's an attempt, there's an attempt in the legislature to change the funding for catastrophic claims, which we, Michigan now, under no-fault insurance, you're essentially fully covered for as long as you need it. If you're in a catastrophic car accident, this was rammed through the Senate in a single day. It's now before the House, and probably the main person opposing this is Brooks Patterson, the Republican executive of Oakland County. I'd like to know, first of all, what all your take on is this going to pass, and what the effect will be if it does?
Well, Jonathan, you've been in some of the hearings, right?
Actually, a coworker of mine has, but I've been following them from a distance. I mean, it certainly has, I think, more momentum than the effort did last year. This is right. Something they try that's tried every couple of years because, you know, Michigan insurance costs are high. Part of that is the MCCA fee, right, which we pay, which is what, about
$186
right now. So there's always, that's the justification for going after this issue. That said, a lot of the bills that have been proposed don't always guarantee that motorists are going to see that savings.
Right.
This particular proposal they're talking about now guarantees savings for 2 years.
2 years.
After that, it's a crapshoot.
It's $100 per year.
Sure. So
$200 you would save.
Yeah. Jack, you wrote a column about this. I think. Wishful thinking, right? You expect
right.
that insurance companies are actually...
See that pie? The pie up there? You'd be surprised.
Be real good.
Yes. But is it going to make it? Is it going to pass the House?
I don't know. I mean, it's already changed significantly in the House, so it'll have to go back to the Senate. The Senate rushed this thing through in 2 days.
Right.
They had a hearing, and the reason they rushed it through is because at that very moment, with that particular proposal, they had the votes to pass it.
Right.
So they rammed it through. Now that it's changed in the House, it's going to come back, and if it does come back, it's going to be a...
Matt, what do you think?
It's not going to happen. For every day, look, if they were going to do this, to give you the dark side of the legislature, they would have moved it like they did in the Senate. Now, I don't in any way condone that, But the house would have been prepped and they'd have moved it the same way and it would have been done. For every day that's gone by since that's happened, somebody has gotten to a vote in the House and it's not going to move. Or if it does, it's going to come back on concurrence, and the senators who maybe were the 19th or 20th, 21st vote are going to say to themselves, you know what? I don't think so. I voted for it the first time, but it's coming back different, and I was iffy on the first one, so no thank you. Good try, but this is my third time seeing this same attempt.
And meanwhile, just this week, $800,000 being spent in TV ads against it, and every day that those trickle down and people start to try to at least better understand what it could be losing, that is a day that I think also constituents are calling. There was actually a fine written piece, I shouldn't say that, so surprised, by Mitch Albom in the Detroit Free Press, who really went at the issue and then at the very end said, here's where you can contact your legislator, and every day that that's happening is one more day, Matt. I think you're right.
But, and there has to be reform, don't get me wrong. There needs to be some changes and tweaks, but they went about it the wrong way. And that's
a meat axe instead of a scalpel. I'll get to sex later, but Kristen has some other questions.
That was a forward promote, as we like to say in the radio business.
Chuck Foles, I'm a local planning commissioner, school board president, resident for over 25 years. And on the previous issue, I've invested in so many tires and wheels and front end alignments, I'd like to see the roads fixed. But in terms of no-fault insurance and catastrophic claims and the insurance cost problem in the state of Michigan, there is one state in the union that over the last 21 years has had a decrease in insurance rates, car insurance rates. That's California. The rest of the states have had increases. Michigan, 69% in the last 21 years. Why can't the legislature look at what California has done, which is pretty clear, which regulates the market, which Michigan does not do, and provides very specific relief to good drivers?
I don't know a whole lot about California's situation, I'm sorry, but regulatory framework, I'm sorry, but I'll say this, insurance companies claim already, because Michigan has this very unique no-fault law with unlimited medical coverage, that it's already a risk for them to be participating here. That's what they claim. I don't know if it's true, so additional regulations, the insurance industry is going to fight that tooth and nail.
Another question?
Hi, my name is Tom Doan, and I'm a retired public school teacher. And when I started teaching, one of the perks for the job is that my pension was not going to be taxed. 4 years ago, it was taxed at a 3% rate. And I understand that in the near future, it may be also taxed at another 4%. I'd like to have some comments about that. Since Proposal 1 is the only one that I can vote on and say, no, you can't increase my taxes, I, at this point, will be voting no on that.
I think they would be politically insane to go back and touch that pension tax and raise it again. It was not a wise political move in the first place. But if they go back and jack it up again,
I just don't see that
happening. I can't fathom it, but they could look for, as I said, new streams of revenue that aren't going to cost you money if you don't want them.
Anybody else have any thoughts on that?
I think it's what the governor said. It's what Republican lawmakers who voted it said, is that, you know, we're not necessarily increasing the taxes. We're taking away an exemption on the pensions. Now, whether that's fair or not, you know, Michigan is one of the states that did that. Other states don't. And this governor has come to say that he wants to make sure that, you know, the millennials, let's say, you know, U of M students, MSU students, Wayne State students are staying here. And that one of the things he needs to do is to gain more money to create a better economy. And that, you know, folks whose pensions weren't taxed suddenly should. And that's where he's looking to begin a next generation to stay here. So whether you believe that argument or not, I think that's the one that Republicans, you know, push through that legislation.
Well, my analysis, and these fellows are welcome to disagree, of the last election was that the pension tax was the biggest reason that Snyder's margin went from 18% the first time to 4% the second time.
Correct.
And it's interesting to wonder if Democrats didn't do something wrong there and spend so much time in that last month between August and November talking about education budget cuts. And should have focused more on the pension cuts, because let's look at who actually votes. It's older folks, rather than, you know, it's not K through 12 kids that are pretty much a vote whose budgets are being cut. So.
Sure. So the pension tax
will that would make things fun.
Maybe that's what you're referring to.
So fun.
So as you get older, you might move into different.
Way more area. Women asking questions. Is any women that are
asking? I'm like nobody from nowhere.
I don't believe that.
I don't believe that for a second.
No, seriously. I don't follow a lot of politics, but what I do follow is, you know, when I put my faith into legislature, I expect them to do what they promise.
Right.
And when they started the lotto, they promised that would fund education.
Right.
They didn't tell us it would replace the education fund. They told us it would supplement education. So we thought, yeah, we're doing a good thing, right? And then, okay, they're gonna add a gas tax. And that gas tax is gonna help fund the roads. So I'm riding on the roads. I don't mind paying a few cents extra for my gas if that's gonna help the roads be better. So now all of a sudden I'm looking at, the roads are not adequate, the gas tax is not adequate, you want more from me, what more can we give?
I think you've just given the best capsule summary I've ever heard of why this is likely to lose. People around the state feel exactly the same way you do.
And it's why, I mean, not just here in Michigan, it's why Congress is what, negative approval ratings right now? I mean, I think it's like 8 or 11%. Because
we can't do. You know, we've put our trust in them, and we voted for their proposals, and now we're skeptical to the point where we don't want to vote anything in because we don't know what it's going to cost us in the long run. Not the short run, but in the long run.
And I don't think anyone can argue that point. We don't have any longer to do that. It's so retarded. Just keep playing.
In other words, if your lawmakers tell you it's sunny, you're going to put a raincoat on, right? And it's funny, but this is a big problem with government today and the relationship between people and their government.
I want to ask you a question, though, about this, because one of the things that you and I have talked about so much, and I want to hear Jonathan and Matt on this too, though, is that some of this has to do, at least in Michigan, with term limits.
Absolutely.
That you know, this issue of not being able to trust or these short-sighted solutions or saying one thing and doing the other, that it's because right now, and again, the dark side of politics, that most lobbyists in Lansing know 10,000 times more than these lawmakers, that they become these sort of actual civil servants and the lawmakers come in and out. Jack, your favorite joke about, you know, new lawmakers still not being able to find the bathroom at the Capitol. Lobbyists who are writing the bills, who know more, how much do you think term limits goes along with this untrust and the inability to get things done?
Well, I think it's the biggest corrupting influence I've ever seen. If you're a legislator, let's say you're 42 years old, you get elected to the Michigan House, you can serve 6 years, then you have to find another job. In your last 2 years, are you going to care more about the needs of the people or about the needs of the special interest who might give you a job after you're done? I think,
look, the election process was set up to be natural term limits, right? You elect people because that's the natural way to go. You either do your job, you serve your community, and you get reelected, or you don't.
We have term limits. It's called elections.
That's right. That's my point. And so I can tell you, having spent 12 years there and 4 years in Congress, at the state level, it's a problem. It was the single dumbest thing the state did, in my opinion, because you know what? You didn't like all of them all the time. But there were men like my former boss, Congressman Joe Schwartz, who served 20 years in the state Senate. He knew higher education budget better than anybody else there. And he did the right thing, and he had relationships. And that's the other thing that's missing with term limits. There's no time for these guys to develop relationships, especially in a bipartisan way. And that's a problem for governing. That's a problem for governing because people are just out for themselves when they get into that place. And then you know what? They don't have the mentors. They don't have the old bulls that are still left around to teach the young bucks what
exactly.
They're supposed to do.
Exactly.
I agree, but yes, the vote about term limits, they still will support it. A part-time legislature, there was a ballot proposal to move in that direction last year, would have exacerbated a lot of the issues we're talking about. But it sounds
right.
It sounds great. Right?
Like,
yeah, screw these guys. They're not doing our job.
As a reporter, it's one of the, I don't want to say frustrating, right? Because, you know, we don't have necessarily these huge opinions about how things should be. But as a reporter, that's one of the things is that folks are so still, if you looked at approval polls of term limits, it would be like, absolutely, totally, 100%. Get those bums out after a certain amount of year. But when you look at the fundamental problems, a lot of it comes back to term limits. And yet, again, approval rates for it still remain really high.
I want to ask, let's take this lady here, and then I want to ask about sex.
When a man and a woman really love each other.
You told me when I was 63 years later.
Comment about term limits. Michigan's way isn't the only way to do term limits. My state of origin is Nebraska. They have term limits. After two terms, you have to sit out a term.
Ohio has the same thing.
And so it gives someone, it turns legislators over, but then they can come back. And somebody, you know, you have an opponent now who has established a track record and has a voting record. And so you have
Well, Matt Marston, your former boss, Randy Richardville, had floated something like that in his last term when he was in office, something where you would stay in office and then, you know, depending on for a certain amount of time, you would go out to your community and try to get signatures, right? Wasn't that his idea that you would get a certain amount of signatures and then if you got enough community signatures, you would then get to be on the ballot again?
Sure. And he was also just talking about some simple flexibility. It may not be politically viable for somebody to actually, it looks self-serving, right, if you're a lawmaker.
For sure.
You're trying to stay in your job longer. But more flexibility. So right now you can serve a total, you can serve 6 years in the House and 8 years in the Senate, so a total of 14 years. Randy Richardville was talking about why not let somebody serve all 14 years in the House, where they can get to know everybody in the House, or all 14 years in the Senate, where they can get to know colleagues on the other side of the aisle over the course of that 14
but
years, develop that expertise.
But here's the problem. This is going to be very hard to change because the special interest has so much vested in having it the way it is.
Right, why would they want knowledgeable lawmakers
right
now? They could be driving the bus.
I want to start bringing up a question about sex, as I said,
this is pretty on your mind.
It's a pertinent, right? Matt's chasing the answer before he knows what it is. As everybody in the world knows, the Supreme Court heard oral arguments yesterday about same-sex marriage. Michigan is one of, I think, only 13 states that prohibits it. If, as is commonly assumed, the Supreme Court says that there is a right to marry whomever you want, first, what will be the impact, including the economic impact, on Michigan? Zoe?
I don't know where
to go. You know, Jack, I don't think that much. I think nationally right now, this is a social issue that has changed so dramatically since Michigan voted in 2004 for a constitutional ban on same-sex marriage. That was about 40% for same-sex marriage, so 60% approved it. We're right now, this is what, 11 years later, now 60% nationally approving same-sex marriage. I don't think much is going to change. Economically, I think it's going to be that same-sex couples can get married, and we'll move on.
People might be a lot happier. I mean, look, I don't care what anyone in this room does in their own life. In their own personal life. I don't care. I'm okay with me and what I am, and whatever anybody else is should be that way. And if people look at it that way, maybe they'll be a little happier, and maybe they'll spend a little bit more money, and maybe they'll smile a little bit more, and maybe they'll do all kinds of things.
More kids may be adopted in Michigan.
First of all, I don't know how this is about sex. I thought people had less sex once they get married. I think if Michigan became one of only a handful of states that didn't allow guaranteed marriage, it could be an economic issue. Certainly, a lot of gay couples right now going to New York to get married, going to Ontario to get married, would probably love to get married in northern Michigan or the UP, so the cat industry.
Municipalities can set fees for the marriage licenses, and somebody that's marrying them gets make a little bit of money here and there,
right.
A dead planner gets money, a niche community.
And the same reason businesses right now are pushing the legislature to update the state's non-discrimination law to include gays and lesbians is because it'll look bad for businesses trying to recruit people. I mean, they're very talented gay people graduating from universities with great degrees.
So
I
don't
think they care for the ones that can't
pass.
Haven't
said
all
that,
Larson, to start with. That's
right.
Take a step back. It relates to that. Having said all that, Jonathan, then why the push for religious freedom restoration?
Because my former boss used to say there's a bunch of right-wing whack jobs that think that that's a good idea politically.
I'll let the Republicans say that, so that's right.
Are they doing it, Matt? Are they doing it? Because now this is a bill that Governor Snyder has already said he will veto. Are they doing it because of their sincere belief, or are they doing it to pander to the religious right?
I don't know what the answer to that is, other than the fact that either they're term limited and don't care what happens in the general election, or they really truly are, that's the way they feel, and that's what they think their constituency feels, and I think that they probably should come talk to me, and I will explain demographically why that is not the case across the state.
And we saw what happened in Indiana earlier this year. And I think that's then when this governor, Rick Snyder, who tends to, as just will give both Jonathan and I early gray hair, when you ask the governor to tell us how he's thinking about a piece of legislation, he'll say he doesn't deal in hypotheticals, and he's going to wait till it gets on his desk, that he doesn't even let the legislature do its job. And when the governor told Kathy Gray at the Detroit Free Press that he would veto RFRA unless, and let's make sure we do that asterisk, unless it added protections, Elliot Larson civil rights protections, that he would veto that. I mean, I think all of our jaws just dropped.
He doesn't do hypotheticals.
He never does hypotheticals.
Can you imagine how frustrated his wife must be? What do you want for dinner? I don't do hypotheticals.
You're worried about gray hair? Don't say too long. You end up like that.
So, you know, that, and again, a governor who, let's be really clear here, does not want to deal with these social issues.
Right.
This is a governor who wants to, like, longer than a 10-foot pole, 100-foot pole. Yeah, I mean, he does not want to have to deal with this. He is a Republican from Ann Arbor. He wants to deal with economic issues. He wants to turn around. He wants to do the economy in Detroit. He does not want a RFRA bill. He does not want to have to decide on same-sex marriage. He wants to stay far away.
Remember right to work. Similar position that he took on that issue.
Sure. And if the governor is dipping his whole foot at this point into presidential waters,
right.
I mean, we saw the backlash against Mike Pence in Indiana,
right.
Who was at one point, I don't think is considered a legitimate presidential candidate anymore after that.
Oh, no, but he was until he just disastrous interview with George Stephanopoulos when he could just not answer whether RFRA was in fact discriminatory or not.
Snyder is also taking kind of an interesting approach. Or he hasn't said he'd veto it, but he's at least saying he's carefully reviewing it, which is covert, but I don't really like it, LGBT adoption bill or a religious objection adoption bill that would allow faith-based agencies to continue to deny service.
And get state funding, which I think the Supreme Court's likely to deal with. You know, even though my panelists are all more knowledgeable than I, they've overlooked one part of this, which is that, does anybody here know what group in society stands to benefit most economically if we legalize same-sex marriage? Divorce lawyers.
Oh, I was going to say therapists.
Questions, next question.
Hi, Johnny Gillis. I'm a public school teacher. I spent 22 years in the Air Force before I started that. And Matt, I'd like to direct my question to you. You've mentioned two or three times about how a new UAW contract is going to cost the state money. And I'm just wondering explain that to us, how that's going to work, please.
Well, I don't work for the unions, but I do or the negotiators on the other side, and I know that Ford has given a substantial increase in pay. And I think when the UAW comes to renegotiate, they're going to look to have an equal pay grade as that, and that's gonna cost the MEDC tax credits are gonna, all the tax credits, it's all interrelated into it. And inevitably it will cost the state more money, higher wages, but we want those jobs. We want them to keep working.
But gee, Mr. Marsden, if they're getting paid higher wages, won't they pay more income tax to the state?
I would hope so. But I think that there's a lot of them, right? Anyone out there in the union? Anyone? Nobody? So you, when you guys renegotiate, there's a lot of terms and conditions that go into that in terms of additional costs and subsidies and things that the government, that they give, that they get, right? Correct?
Actually, it won't happen this time because what the UAW, at least as far as we're concerned, they're going to renegotiate, and the tier one is going to get a lot closer to the tier two wage.
And then the tier two is going to become a tier three.
So beautiful, so we only had a $900 million shortfall. If Ford's goes up, though, don't they, did they match it on the four, on the last month?
The living is gone. Been gone.
All right. Well, there you go. You still got a $900 million asset, though.
But I'm hearing the same thing that, you know, 10 years ago, this whole tier one, tier two seemed like the biggest deal. We were all like, oh, my gosh, and now we're here for tier two and tier three. It's pretty remarkable. And it's remarkable that in a state like Michigan, we have, what, three hands part of unions in a room like this in Brighton? That's pretty surprising.
Yes, next question.
I'm Dan Legend. I'm an industrial salesman. That doesn't matter. What I've got to say is...
even if this issue is
yes. Who was, if this is an inside politics question, who was the emissary that went from Schneider to Carl Levin to get him in the ads?
Well, the firm that's actually running the campaign, Martin Waymeyer, tends to work with Democrats more often, actually, than Republicans. So it probably had pre-existing
For those of you that haven't seen it, Uncle Carl Levin, recently out of the Senate, has recently been doing a pro-proposal one ad.
Well, Grandpa Munster, as they used to call it, John Sturgis.
Levin was willing to do the ad. Interestingly, he wasn't willing to talk to the media about it.
But I wouldn't say...
That literal footnote in an email that wasn't actually there.
Serious, I wouldn't see anything nefarious about this. Levin has nothing left to prove. There's nothing that Levin wants or that Snyder can give him. Most of the long-time establishment politicians in this state are in favor of Proposal 1. And I think this would just, I think that Senator Levin is being totally sincere about his belief about this. Next question.
Hi, my name is Rich Kohlberg.
You used to be a publisher, but you got cured.
I retired from the newspaper industry where I spent most of my career in absolute awe of the legend that is Jack Lessig.
Now you know what we always say in the newspaper business, you can never trust a publisher.
My question is about the newspaper industry and the steadily declining readership. And is there a substitute, is there a connection for what you've been talking about today with the lack of influence of newspapers? All due respect to radio and websites, do you see any institution taking the place of what print journalism used to do?
Well, I'd like anyone to weigh in on that, but for me, I think this is, you sort of hit the nail on the head as far as having an informed public goes. In 1985, I was a national editor the Detroit News. Its daily circulation, print circulation, was 670,000. You know what it is today? It's 63,000. And that's drastic, but all papers have suffered this kind of loss. People aren't reading newspapers, and we have a very fragmented information base for the general public. I don't know what kind of intellectual furniture people have, and no one has figured out how to monetize the internet. But I may be too close to this, and my colleagues may have some better ideas than I, starting with Zoe.
Well, I mean, I of course have to give a shout out to some of our reporters at Michigan Radio, who I think are really doing amazing work. We've got Rick Pluta, my co-host of It's Just Politics, who is one of, I mean, besides Jack, one of the most amazing brains, and who comes with so much institutional knowledge about Lansing. We've also got things like Bridge Magazine, Michigan Radio and Bridge Magazine, trying to figure out relationships to tell those stories. But as Jonathan could tell you, the Lansing Press Corps is not what it was 2 decades ago, even a decade ago, and 10 years ago, as Matt's saying. And absolutely, I mean, how can you not see some sort of pinpoint between that? That as there are fewer reporters doing fewer investigative, fewer enterprise stories, or not less.
And they, and also, to add to that, I mean, Zoe's absolutely right. Bridge Magazine, which was founded by your and my former boss, Phil Power, is fantastic. But you were the publisher of the Livingston County Daily Press and Argus, longest name for a newspaper in the country. If it moved in Howell, you covered it. If somebody did something on the school board in Brighton, you covered it. That may not be the case anymore. Ann Arbor doesn't have a daily newspaper. So as that Greek guy named Plato said, who's guarding, who's watching the Guardians? Who's guarding the Guardians? And I think that's a problem. John?
Yeah, I agree with everything everybody's saying. I come from a little different angle, which is that I've never worked for a traditional newspaper. I've only worked for mlive.com, which is an online-only publication. But as Jack mentioned, you know, monetization of the internet for news is a fledgling proposition that hasn't really paid off as of yet, as I understand it. Don't quote me on that. But yeah, I know what to say. I agree. I think Bridge is a really interesting experiment. Right now, there are a lot of different experiments out there. Bridge is a nonprofit, which is essentially a philanthropic endeavor to provide news. The question is, will they reach enough people for that philanthropy to have a great impact? MLive, of course, sort of blazed a trail in terms of online-only news that now a lot of other newspapers in Michigan are following. There's also, experiments. Going back to Bridge, they're actually now partnering with a for-profit entity, Cranes Detroit, to pay for a full-time business reporter to be in Lansing. It's going to be paid by both entities. Sort of an interesting hybrid model, but yeah, it's a tough time for the industry.
Matt, do you think people are less well informed?
No, my wife would like newspapers to go away. I wouldn't have so much black fingers and leaving my marks all over the place, and the five or six papers that I actually buy because I'm kind of old school and I have to read it with my highlighter and cut it out and save it and then be reminded of it. But I mean, I'm a dying breed too. I think a lot of people aren't doing it that way. But the Wall Street Journal, New York Times, Metro Times, Detroit Free Press, Detroit News, I got to print off his articles so I can actually physically hold it on paper. But I don't know, how many of us are going to be left to do that anymore. I can tell you that there's something to be said to sit down with a newspaper and actually take a few minutes to physically read it. Don't click, don't spin, don't skip, whatever it is we do, to actually sit, open it, turn the page. And you know what? People are working to make that paper. People are delivering it. People are getting jobs from it. So I hope it doesn't go away.
And the reality is you probably have as much access to news as you've ever had. I mean, our page view, mobile page view, going through the roof. People are literally, have news at their fingertips 24/7, whether it's the same quality, whether it's the same depth, or whether they're only going to the sites that reinforce their pre-existing beliefs.
Isn't that the issue, too, that with the internet comes, so many more news stories, but it also creates a bit of your own neighborhood, your own society. You're clicking on the links that are reinforcing what you believe.
That's right. And there's another prop thing that, because of your extreme youth, you may be overlooking. One of my many, like most disreputable people, I have multiple jobs. One of my jobs is to deal with reader complaints for the paper in Toledo, Ohio. And a woman complained that she, anytime she wanted to know something in depth, this was a lady in her 70s, she was directed to the internet. And she wasn't on the internet. And I wrote a column saying that perhaps editors should realize that many readers, including the most loyal readers, but not that comfortable online, my phone rang off the hook for days with people who are happy about that. There are still people who don't read online. They don't. There are a lot more people who don't like to read online. As everybody mentioned, we read differently. So again, we've got a fragmented audience. It's also, the thing that concerns me the most is it's relatively easy for Matt and Jonathan, Zoe and I to get news about Lansing. We get a special service that tells us that. We know where to look. So I think we have a small number of people who are very well informed and a large number of people who are essentially uninformed. Yeah. Now, if you look at history, societies like that include the later Roman Empire, Russia in 1917. These generally did not have good outcomes. And that's what I worry about.
We're preaching to the choir here tonight, right?
You guys are not the guys that we worry about.
Yeah.
Kristen has a victim over there.
Hi, Chuck Taylor, an engineer.
Hey, Chuck.
Back to the 1% sales tax thing. I guess I thought I heard earlier that a gas tax was considered, but was not palatable. I'm not sure how, but
I think that's what you're going to get next.
Yeah, a straight gas tax,
yes.
A standalone gas tax, was not palatable. What lawmakers did is they passed a sales tax increase that was tied to all these other bills. So a gas tax increase would actually be triggered, but they still didn't have to vote for it themselves.
I guess my thought is, if it's a direct gas tax, that would be users of the road would be paying for the
road. That'd be a rough justice in that, yes.
Yes, and I guess I look at Europe, where the roads are sublime, the gas tax is also very high, but this is a market-driven fuel efficiency incentive as well. And in light of our windfall low gas prices, it seemed to be a perfect time to pursue this.
Well, and that's what they're talking, or they were a few months ago with the federal government, you know, pushing for this transportation highway bill, trying to find bipartisan support and say, now is the time because gas prices are at a historic low.
Yeah, so the governor's original proposal, as I mentioned, was a gas tax and registration hybrid, and he called it a user tax.
And everyone started calling it a birthday tax.
Yeah, everyone called it a birthday tax. But yeah,
okay, thank you.
If you're sure you
say it now.
Oh, you're such a crack sandwich.
If you're gonna have to raise taxes, that would be the most elegant solution, yes, but the legislative process is not elegant and you've got proposals on this stuff.
But let me just talk about the birthday tax. Look, when you guys have to rent it, it's not cheap when your birthday comes around, is it? And if you got one car, two cars, snowmobile, motorcycle, boat, trailer, what else moves?
Marshall makes a lot of money.
I don't have those things, but somebody else might. But that to me was an ill-conceived plan because it nicks you every year. And depending on the vehicle you have, it goes up and down. That was not the right way to go. That was another false start that needed to be stopped. Let me just preface that.
I would not support
and that arson stopped it in its tracks, ladies and gentlemen.
I would not support the registration tax, but I still think a fuel tax is most efficient, straightforward, and direct way.
I think that's what they're going to come back with. I think that when this goes down, they're going to come back and say, all right, let's try this cleaner. Let's see if we can do this with the gas tax. You'll still have the arguments you guys know about, well, what part of this goes to education? And what part of this goes to the roads, right? But at the end of the day, if they do their job and get smart about how they message it and how they sell it to you, you'll buy it.
Are you suggesting they'll do that as a ballot proposal or that the legislature will enact?
I think they'll try it legislatively first.
I do.
There could be a second ballot proposal in the works. I don't know what it's going to be yet. But there is one issue with the gas tax as the perfect solution, which is that, the problem we have now is that gas tax revenue is declining because people are driving more fuel-efficient vehicles, they're driving electric cars, hybrids, etc., or simply driving less. You know, people of my generation are increasingly choosing to use public transportation instead, or at least if we're not owning cars. But anyways, so that was the problem with the last gas tax increase in 1997. It didn't have any inflationary mechanism. So what they'd probably look to is a wholesale gas tax, which is actually part of Prop 1, that could rise a certain percentage each year to sort of match inflationary increases and actually retain its value over time.
Until the Saudis stop pumping gas out and you're driving at $4.43 a gallon again, you'll all be calling for our heads for suggesting that it was a good idea.
That's why we have this other program we're unveiling tonight to encourage people to buy Hummers. I was very baffled by the resistance to doing this through gas tax because not only is gas very low, I mean, I thought at one point this winter I paid $1.80 a gallon. I thought I'd come home and then Ronald Reagan would be president again. But gas always fluctuates wildly. It may fluctuate as much as 80%, 90%, 90 cents a gallon in the course of a normal year. And I would think after the initial kerfuffle, people wouldn't notice it. It would be seen as the most painless way.
I thought this was issues and ale. There's a lot of empty glasses.
Let's try to get another couple questions in here for people who haven't asked them before. Sir. Ma'am.
I have a question. It's more comment, maybe a question for you. Haven't they already stolen our gas tax money that was supposed to go for the roads and put it towards something else? Because I think I remember this in my lifetime, that they have a gas tax. It was supposed to go all towards toward roads. They got a little extra surplus, and they stole it, which is why we're not from, we're in the place we are now.
That is not true.
Stealing is a heavy allegation. I like to call it reapportionment.
Statutorily, the gas tax has to go to transportation.
Good.
Transportation can include mass transit. Critics will point out it's for things like bike trails and stuff. But that's all part of the transportation network. Because that money is statutorily obligated for those, for transportation purposes. Mostly.
And there is a portion of the tax that does go to public education, and it's a very complicated form.
Well, that's the sales tax portion on gas.
You guys have a whole sale?
I was asking if we stole gas tax.
We did. We never stole anything.
Not me. No. They.
And the apportion.
Yeah, so right now a portion of every gallon of gas you buy has a sales tax on it, and that money goes to schools and cities, not roads.
Why am I thinking of a line from that classic musical piece, Where Have You Gone, Mrs. Robinson, which goes, either way you look at this, you're screwed. Next question. Next question. Yes. Yes, sir.
Michael Cohen, Ann Arbor, a proud union member of the Michigan Education Association. When Prop 1 is passed, guaranteed amendment to the Constitution, $300 million to schools, $100 million to local government,
right?
If it does not pass, the two bills that are front and center in the legislature, a couple of House bills, 4335 and 6, will change all of that sales tax that's been spoken of to a gas tax, which will cut public education $568 million a year. The difference there is almost a $1 billion cut to public education. We must vote for Prop 1.
Is that accurate?
I'm not sure on all the math, but I mean, in general, yes. The House passed the plan last year. The Senate didn't take it up, but this plan would have essentially diverted what they call future funding increases. So like the sales tax is expected to continue to generate extra money each year. It's going to grow, right? So it would have taken that extra money, they said, and put it towards roads. But yes, it would have taken money away that otherwise would have gone to schools and cities.
Is there one final question on any topic?
And that's been reintroduced.
We've got like a little line. What's it? Can you go through who's there?
Okay, that's the gentleman right here in the hat.
Hi, I'm Nate Warner from Brighton, and I'm an engineer in the automotive industry. I have a question about how we deal with proposals in general. Seems like there's an awful lot of people who've been very interested in saying no to anything. It's like that grumpy cat meme on the internet. When you look at that and it says no, that's what I feel like we've done an awful lot to. So if we say no, we're playing grumpy cat to proposal one. What do we do next? What's the next step?
Legalize marijuana.
Let me say I'm sort of neutral. The reason people tend to vote no on things is because they don't understand them. It's like on a first date. If they ask you to do something and you don't quite understand it, it's always safer to say no. And I think that's what people do. And there's also if there's a psychological effect, if you load the ballot up with more than about two propositions, people just vote no on everything.
Which we saw in 2012, when there were six ballot proposals. It was sort of the year of the ballot, not the year of the draft.
Because people don't understand them. That's psychologically why it happens.
And we did a really interesting interview with a couple of psychologists exactly about that. That it is much easier to vote no when you are, better to be the devil that you know than that you don't.
Can we squeeze one more question?
Well, I'm just going to try to do this quick line and then we'll
move on. Good evening. My name is Christopher Tilby, and
I am a city council member here in Brighton. I'd like to thank Michigan Radio for coming out and this whole
thing. Oh, you're such a politician.
Seriously, it's a new way to
make you guys come here. Find a baby that he can kiss, too.
Don't get your arms up.
But, you know, if Proposal 1 fails, you know, there's a huge part of this that comes back to the local communities.
Right.
It comes back to the schools, it comes back to the municipalities in the form of roads.
Yeah.
I sit out on budget and finance committee right here in Brighton, and, you know, Brighton's a prosperous community. We're doing really, really well.
I'd say.
We've got great redevelopment, but, you know, I gotta say, folks, we can't...
Let me turn this around. I'm glad you mentioned that, because I'm curious about something. All over the state, why aren't people like you out there saying you've got to vote pass this for that reason? Why aren't advocates for the poor out there saying we need to pass this for the EITC? People like yourself seem to be sort of comatose. You would think local government, which has been cut and cut and cut, they would be screaming for this. Tell me why you don't think there's more activism.
And hold the mic just a little higher.
It's a tough political environment out there. I mean, there's a lot of people that are against taxes, regardless of anyway, the cutting.
Right.
Council members here in Brighton, same thing. It's tough to support it.
Sure. That's what it comes down to. It's a tax increase. Does it have a lot of things that people might support? Absolutely. Revenue sharing has been cut over the years. Education funding, we had the great Smith and Shower debate over whether or not that's been cut, but it probably hasn't been increased as much as it could have been. Mass transit money hasn't had a significant increase in years. This would do all that, but it would also raise taxes.
You know, that's cheerful, though.
I want to just say one more really quick thing, which is not just about the city council. This was a state legislator issue, too, about coming out in favor of it. Dave Eggert at the Associated Press did a survey last week of all 148 senators, state reps. 23% of the lawmakers came back and said how they were voting. So not like yes or no, 23% of your lawmakers came out to tell you how they are
77% invertebrates, ladies and gentlemen.
They're not even sure what it's going to do. Let me just add that. They're not quite sure what it's going to do. Okay?
You know, I'd like you to give yourselves a hand because you're the best audience, I think, we've ever had for one of these. Thank you very much. I want to turn this back over to Steve. We'll tell you how you pay for this evening.
Yes, I do want to remind you to make sure you tip the bartenders and the wait staff here. Big round of applause again for Jack and Jonathan and Matt and Joe, our great panelists tonight. Thanks again to the wonderful folks here at Brewery Becker for providing us with the venue. And thank you to all of you for coming out this evening as well. And we hope we'll see you in the future issues in the event.
Jack probably has to hit the road, but we could probably spend a couple minutes here and answer any couple questions. If there were folks who didn't get their questions answered, I'm happy to stay or jump in. Yeah, leave you guys are too for a few minutes, at least about that much time.
All right, thank you very much.